what does it mean for me as a manager or as a leader? What kind of actions, management actions, do I have to put in place if I want to improve the innovation capacity of my organization or organizational unit?
It's not always clear what is it then exactly I as a manager of a team or I as a CEO of an organization can do to change that. And that's a bit where the idea came from.
A fool with a tool remains a fool. So it also needs some guidance, what to do with the results, how to interpret them.
Inside Impact.
Research Spotlight.
Welcome back to Inside Impact, and welcome to a new episode, a new Research Spotlight. Research Spotlight, this is our section where we have a deep dive into one specific research project. And also for today, of course, I'm not doing this alone. I have great support in the studio. With me are Dr. Reinhard Milner, he is head of the Center for Social Entrepreneurship and Social Innovation, and Professor Dr. Jürgen Willems, he is professor for public management and governance, both, of course, here at WU. Jürgen, Reinhard, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you, Martin. I'm doing fine, and thank you for having us in this podcast.
Thanks a lot, Martin. Thanks for the kind invitation.
Of course, Reinhard, for you the second time, I think you've joined us for the topic of sustainability before, together with Milda Schillinsketty.
Indeed, that's true. That's true. Pleasure to be back again.
Great. Yeah. Today, we have a deep dive, as I said, into a specific topic, mainly social innovation. Very briefly, before we start into it, how is your personal and professional relationship to the topic? Why is this relevant for your work?
Well, first of all, it's already carried in our name, carried in the name of the center. So indeed, we deal with topics such as social entrepreneurship, social innovation. In my case, I also engage in impact investing as a research topic, or let's say field. And I'm also doing some work on philanthropy, institutionalized philanthropy, meaning that I research charitable foundations and what they are doing. So it's a core topic of the center, and also in my research, but it's not only reflected in research. So we also have a variety of projects where we support socially innovative organizations in the field, so to say, be it like social enterprises or NGOs or the public sector with its ambitions to also further advance public services, actually. So that's my approach to it, and that's reflected in a number of projects. And one of it, and I'm very fond of it, is the one Jürgen and myself are doing together with some other colleagues as well.
Before we move into the project, Jürgen, very briefly, Reinhard, of course, mentioned already the connection of social innovation and public management and the public sector. Could you maybe please elaborate for your work as well? What does this mean?
Yes. So indeed, I'm very much interested not only in teaching and research, but also just in daily life, in the connection of what nonprofits do to solve problems. And there is, of course, the last 10, 20 years, much more reliance on nonprofits to deliver public services. From them, it's expected to deliver these services, but also bring all the time new solutions to old problems, to new problems. So this minimal level of being innovative, thinking or reflecting on what are good ways to solve the newest problem in town. So that is something like you cannot ignore the topic of social innovation if you think about nonprofits and how they are instructed very often by public organizations to deal with it.
And now, of course, we see already the thematic kind of combination and the thematic congruence, maybe even. Now, academia is, of course, a big field. WU is a big university. Working in the same field doesn't necessarily mean you get to know each other and you work together. How did you find each other for this project?
Well, we know each other for quite some time when we both did our PhD studies, actually. And then we were lucky to receive Jürgen as a professor at WU, so we caught up again, so to speak, and got in touch again. And so on the one hand, social innovation was something that we were dealing with. So we got into a deeper exchange. And then Jürgen also shared his work that he already did with let's say assessment tools. We will come to that in different contexts. So we found some common ground, so to speak, to combine these two experiences. And that was kind of the starting point where we started the discussion and also the development, the joint development of this very specific kind of approach that is rooted in this larger concept of social innovation. Yeah,
indeed. So actually, because of your answer, I've been thinking about it. It's since 2010, I guess, the first PhD workshops across the globe where we would meet. And then, of course, that's a good starting point. And then when I came to Vienna, actually, I remember that many of the first talks were about finding this bridge. It's like we do academics. We had seen each other at academic conferences. Normally in the field, you know quite well from each other what kind of research someone is doing. But like, what is like the access to the practice world? That is not always clear. And I think that's where we quickly found each other. It was like, we have all this background in research. This is our approach of doing research with practitioners. And quite soon the idea was there, let's do something that is research relevant, but very close with people in the field. So, and I think that was the start of this project.
Now, many keywords, they're already practitioners, social innovation, assessing. Of course, we speak today about a tool you created called Matzi, which is about assessing work environments that harvest social innovation. Now, with everything social innovation, before we deep dive into it, what is your understanding in this work of social innovation? What is a social innovation for you?
Well, as always, kind of in academia, by now there is a plethora of definitions out there. What social innovation actually is, what kind of definitions you would find, where you would apply it, are we talking macro, meso, micro level, whatsoever. So different perspectives on the topic, but one quite prominent definition on social innovation is the one that it's about innovative activities and services that are motivated actually by the goal of meeting a social need. So that's a very kind of basic approach. Another one says it's about means and ends that are motivated by a social goal. So one core of it is the intentionality. So really the motivation and the intention to improve society on a general level, to improve social services, for instance, or services in the field of education or whatsoever. So in that sense, with that intention in mind, this could be new forms of organizing the delivery of new social services, or the new delivery, or an innovative form of delivery. It could be addressing new underserved target groups, and it could be new forms of collaboration, for instance, and the like. So many of the societal or social problems are described as wicked, as complex, as large in scale and complex. So that's why this idea of and the need for, or the call for, cross-sector collaboration comes in, which again is a perfect fit with our perspectives on the nonprofit sector, but also from a public sector, public management point of view. So that's in a nutshell. But
yeah. As in a nutshell as a definition for social innovation can get, I guess. Now, Jürgen, you in this project and in this work are having a look at work environments for social innovation. Maybe very briefly, how did this idea came into existence, and why is this connection relevant?
Yes, so actually I am MATSI stands for maturity assessment tool, and then the SIE stands for social innovation environment. So there it comes from. So one of the ideas we had based on the definition that Rainer just gave is, so actually there is quite good research, academic research, but also anecdotal evidence or something, which documents then, look, this was a social innovation. And it's very inspiring, and people get like hyped when they say, oh, that's an interesting innovation, that is cool or something. But what we both learned from talks and also from research, it's not always clear for research and practitioners what they then actually can do to achieve that goal. So very often you see the output of a social innovation, you see this is working, and therefore it becomes a topic or it's a hype even. But it's not always clear what is it then exactly I as a manager of a team or I as a CEO of an organization can do to change that. And that's a bit where the idea came from. So we have an idea of a social innovation as an output, but we are more interested in looking at like how can I as a CEO or as a manager steer, engineer actually a working environment so that the chances for people to be innovative or for my whole team as a whole to come up with innovative solutions for problems. So that's a bit where we said there is already enough research, practitioner research books and so on cool social innovations and how it changed the world. We just wanted to make it more actionable and broader. So to think, to have people reflect on what are these environmental dimensions that they actually can steer, where they can make decisions. And if they actually make the environment, let's say, more supporting, then there's going to be a higher likeliness that the team or individuals will come up with social innovative solutions for problems. So that's where the idea came from. Yes.
So we basically look at the organizational level, right? So what can organizations do? What can they address? What can managers improve, so to speak, when they aim for coming up with new innovation, socially intended innovations, or how to improve their operation? So it could be that we look at an organization as an entity, right? So like a social enterprise or a smaller NGO or a nonprofit. Or it could be that we look and work with larger organizations where we basically look at an organizational unit, right? So it's the meso level, as we would call it.
And maybe to boil it down a little bit more even, now environment is, of course, a big word again, like different people understand different things. Is it like a spatial environment? I guess yes, but not only would be my guess. What are factors in this environment which can be changed?
Yes. So it's a maturity assessment tool. So how we started in developing was going through the literature, going to our own experience, evidence, a lot of talks with people. So we wanted to have like a bunch of dimensions. From a practical point of view, you do not want to measure hundreds of them. That's very unpractical. And then probably from a certain amount of dimensions, you're just measuring always the same. So we just want enough so that you can have enough detail. But you also just don't want one main dimension, social innovative versus not social innovative. That doesn't give enough information. So we looked at multiple dimensions. And we had actually two selection criteria. The one is what also Reinhard already mentioned is we want in the end that it describes a certain work unit in an organization so that that unit also can do something with the information. It doesn't make sense to ask information on a dimension that the manager cannot steer him or herself. It doesn't make sense. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is in selecting these dimensions, you also want dimensions that each measure separate things. You do not want to measure all the time the same or things that anyway highly correlate. So what are these dimensions? Indeed, you said it. It's a one element, only one of the big, it's actually five main dimensions with each time three sub-dimensions. So it's 15 in total. And we did some testing that they really measured different things. I will now just go over the five main dimensions. And one of that is indeed infrastructure. So because there is a lot of research, if the right infrastructure is there, if you can work in a nice work environment, if you do have the right tools, if you have like basic IT support, this kind of stuff, then you don't have to worry about all of this. And there is a lot of research that makes people more innovative. It gives them some extra capacity and so on and so on. But we do not only look at the physical elements. There's also something we call it workplace social capital. It's also in the research very often studied. Like if people in a team really fit well together, it's something like a social capital element in there. A lot of research says like if you have this, then people feel safe to share ideas. And if they feel safe to share ideas, again, the likeliness of being social innovative is higher. Culture is also a thing, specifically the culture of continuous improvement. Does this organization or this team have something like, okay, we're doing stuff, we evaluate ourselves, are we getting better? Are we indeed dealing with this problem, or is the problem actually even getting worse? So this idea, this culture of testing oneself, looking at data, also evaluations and so on, that's an element. Another dimension where we also had quite some interesting learning points, but we might come back to that later, is the level of autonomy. There should be within the team enough autonomy for people so that they can decide themselves how to solve problems, but also the team or the organization as a whole should have also enough autonomy. As some organizations, they are highly regulated with laws, or their funders would almost decide on every smallest decision. That's not a lot of autonomy, and you will see that these organizations will likely not be as innovative and commit new solutions. And the fifth dimension is we call it outward orientation, which is the organization should all the time have some radar in knowing what is going on. So do they have like some structures, formal and informal, to know what stakeholders want, what they do not want? Do they have something like a market sense, like what is working? How can I, with the right rhetoric, with the right arguments, convince funders, policymakers, and so on? So that is the fifth dimension. And that is a little bit, if you take them all together, and we know it, we have now analyzed quite a bit of teams and organizations, they do not standardly correlate. Sometimes an organization is really, really good in work social capital, but they do not have a continuous improvement culture, or they have actually no clue what the environment or the ecosystem is thinking. So the work social capital is one of the conditions then fulfilled, but they're not likely to be coming up with social innovative solutions because the other elements are missing. So that's how we look at environments. So both the physical thing, but also the social thing, but also the culture element of it. Yes.
And Reinhard, maybe very quickly, is it then the more the merrier, the more the better? So from each of these factors, the higher you rank, basically, the better it is for social innovation?
Well, thanks for that question. What you would need to add is that it's not only that we do this with one organization, and we'll explain this, but discuss the results with them alone. The tool has also kind of a benchmarking function. So as Jürgen said, we have done this with pretty much 50 organizations and organizational units by now. So that gives us the opportunity to also do kind of a comparison. But to quote Jürgen again, he tends to say, a fool with a tool remains a fool. So it also needs some guidance, what to do with the results, how to interpret them, because, of course, these organizations are different. So the tool rather acts as an opportunity to reflect on this, not necessarily to look for where am I at the ranking in the respective dimensions or whatsoever, but to also start the discussion on what kind of hypotheses do I as a leader of an organization have, why this result came up, and how can this be compared and discussed with peers from other organizations. Does this meet your question?
I think so, yeah. So it's of course not like maximizing each of those factors, but really having a look, okay, for me as a leader or for our organization or for our unit, where are potential points where we can improve, which might be based on the data as well.
But something to add there, in our workshops, as Reinhard said, we have like the tool, which is based on a survey, and then we create this feedback report. And in this feedback report, benchmarking is very central. Just a small detail, they always get their own organization-specific report. So then there is a lot of graphs in it, and they themselves are always the, let's say, the red line or the red dot in a graph. But all the other 50 are in there as the blue dots. Then they are not named, so they get like always, they see where they are compared to about 50 other organizations. And the second part is a workshop. It's really a full day workshop. Sometimes we do it one-on-one with one organization, 3-4 people of that organization, and we go through steps, because it is, I think a lot of managers do have the skill of looking at a report, let's say half an hour, and learn something from it. We see that there is a lot of value of going through and really think through every graph or something. And that workshop is the other element. And to answer your question, both from, let's say, research, from analyzing the data, but also from their feedback and so on. There is something like, very often people come in with that assumption, like, the more the better, and look, 2 out of 5 dimensions are really good. This is fine. If we continue asking questions, then very often it's the other way around. It's the weak spots, which are something like insufficient but necessary conditions. So if that condition is not fulfilled, it doesn't matter how good you are on these 2 other dimensions. And that is very often, we just put it in the workshops there as an idea to think about. We put them sometimes in smaller groups to think about it. And then you see indeed that that's very often the rhetoric where they say, like, indeed, it doesn't matter that we're in this nice building infrastructure and that we are best friends forever, workplace social capital. As long as we do not know what our stakeholders want, that's the outward orientation, it doesn't matter that we're the best friends. We're just not getting our potential out of it. So it's a complex way of thinking. And it's true. If people would just get the report on their desk and quickly check and they say, oh, we're good in this and that dimension, they talk about it in the next board meeting, check, next problem to solve. We actually know that it's much more complex, and a part of the tool and the workshop is about realizing that and making themselves a little bit these mental models of, like, how do these things relate in general, but also specifically in our organization. And that helps in setting priorities, because looking at a document like that, you can come up with 50 learning points. This helps in prioritizing a little bit, like, what are the real weak spots, which necessary conditions are not fulfilled. And then they know we should prioritize there first with some management actions.
Really nice, yeah. Now, you mentioned already you are doing workshops with the organizations or with the units, and also surveys. Is it then basically that every organization or every organizational employee basically is taking part in this? Or do you have like subgroups where you say, okay, those are the ones who know enough about the topic, maybe even, or are relevant for assessing the work environment?
So the way we work, and that's something we also learned from other projects. I think we did optimize it a lot in this project. So what we always do is, so we also give it a little bit as a service. This is our impact in the world. So what we do is we have to find this one key contact person. And he or she's really like central. And we do prep that person. And we also say it, like, the better you do your work, the better the feedback report will be. And with better doesn't mean like better scores. It just means like you will learn more. And also, if you convince as a key contact person a lot of people in your team or organization to participate, then you do not have to feel shameful to go with that document and say, I suggest we change this and this in the organization, because it's based on the opinions of all these people. So that is a little bit how we work. So we have this key contact person and we do prep them. So they should indeed try to have a big amount of people in the team or the organization. But again, for us, from a research point of view, that's always good. In a paper, it reads like a high response rate. But also for them, it's like if they can say, look, I got this report from Reinhard and Jürgen, and we're working together also with Caroline Waldner on this. They get this feedback report. And if they then can say, like, hey, my team is, let's say, 20 people, 18 of them answered this, they can use the document to convince the team, like, hey, people, this is your opinion. So go on, let's go on with this. Like, I know now what your opinion is. I learned it from this report. So let's do something with it. So that is the approach. It's again a bit finding a good balance. The more the better, we say, in terms of respondents and representativeness. We also get it, it's not always possible, but it is mainly for them so that they can learn from it and that it's reliable what they learn from it.
So maybe to recap the process, because we walk the mentioned leaders and the organizations through a process. So they get an introduction. They are asked to run the survey within their organization, organizational unit, and Jürgen will maybe say a few words about the survey, how it is constructed, and so on. This leads into individual reports for the organization, and that is followed up by reflection workshops, and we also do follow-up research, but that's an afterthought. We also do follow-up research, but that's an additional story. I often tend to describe it to practitioners as, when it comes to to the process as a what is in organizational development and the consultancy context called a survey feedback approach. So there is a survey and we provide feedback. But we are not consultants. And it's different from that sense that it's not that we show up and look at the figures and see here you are weak and here you are not, but we provide later on an opportunity where those leaders and organizations can exchange and develop their own approaches. What does it mean for me as a manager or as a leader? What kind of actions, management actions do I have to put in place if I want to improve really the innovation capacity of my organization or organizational unit?
Now, you mentioned already around 50 organizations have already taken part or have been analyzed or collaborated with you. Can you tell us a little bit about those? I mean, I know, of course, anonymity, but is this tool rather used up until now by, I don't know, large multi-service providers? Or is it the small organization which with 5 to 10 employees which says, okay, where can we as a whole organization improve?
A very good question. So we decided actually along the way when we developed it, it should be as broadly applicable as possible. So at some point we also decided, for example, a typical thing is like if it would only focus on nonprofits, then you can have some questions on volunteers as stakeholders. We decided not to do that. So technically it is relevant for non-profit, for-profit, and public organizations. And that's also, we have all three in the sample. So that is a thing. And the other element is, so we also realized if we have a certain key contact person, can be as a part of an educational program, but also can be a part of a project we're doing. So if we have this key contact person and he or she is responsible for just one department, then it also can be a department, again, in all three sectors. So that is a bit the idea. And we also pushed it that it should be relevant for small and big. So the idea is if you have a good team in a big organization, or if the team is the organization, 5 people, these 5 dimensions, they are not sector specific and they are not size specific. So that's the idea. And we actually, if there was literature, but there is not a lot of research and literature on it, work social capital is relevant in all three sectors, in big, small, depending, regardless of industry. That's what I meant. So, and it's with all these dimensions. So fair enough. Sometimes it's true that when we talk this through, that a small organization says, yeah, for us, it's hard to have nice infrastructure. But then for them, maybe something else is better. But that's more in the explanation, because sometimes you also have small organizations who say, yeah, we have this huge funder and we can actually be like, we have a whole floor in their company where we can do whatever we want. So sometimes a reason is given why they are good or not so good, or they assess themselves as good or better in a certain dimension. So that, like the sector or the size or the background or the history of the organization, might be given as a reason, but it's not that we find that standardly. And another final thing about the sample, it is true that we have technically more nonprofits in it, but that is just maybe because they are more interested in getting some feedback on the social innovation kind of logic. But we even had a small marketing company at some point. We have some. We have also some nonprofits that are almost completely funded through public funding, like in contracts, service contracts with the government. So it's very hybrid, and we developed it on purpose so that anyone can participate.
I mean, it sounds like, apart from the anonymity, that this could be a great community as well, right? Of socially innovative organizations or organizations which are interested in the topic, if this is somehow manageable, just thinking about this.
I think it's a good point, but we also have to be fair there. It's also sometimes the other way around, because with the executive program that Reinhard is running on social innovation, people come into that program, and of course we do offer it to some of the participants there. So it is sometimes already a community. The tool helps to make it stronger. Another thing is, because it is already sometimes a community or a group of people who know each other, the workshops afterwards are much more valuable, because they know each other. For this particular program, program on social innovation management, is they know each other. And if they, in the final day of the program, by the way, they do get this feedback report, we go the whole day through, they know each other very well. They have been studying together, but also partying together. They are very free in explaining each other their own situation. That's where the real IDs come from. They say, you have a low score on infrastructure. We have a high score. They sit really literally next to each other in a workshop during lunch then or something, and they are exchanging IDs. So that it is a community, that is very often an extra plus why these workshops are very successful. It might, or the tool in itself might strengthen the community a little bit. But at this point, it's because we go to communities that it works rather than the other way around.
Now, having the data, the results of those many organizations in mind, what are, from your perspective, the results which are organizations like often surprised by, or even yourselves? What are you maybe surprised by? What came out of the past 50-plus analysis?
Thanks a lot for that question. The anecdote, let's put it that way, that comes to my mind is the following. So one of the organizations was a social startup in the field of, let's say, digital social innovation. So coming up with digital solutions that improve society or some needs in the target group. So it's a digital social startup working a lot with digital tools, with digital solutions in the field of social innovation. So when we looked at the results from the survey, it was really striking that on the dimension of digital capabilities, they ranked or rated themselves or assessed themselves quite low. So I was wondering about this, because how can this be that they assess themselves lower than other organizations and so on? And one hypothesis or explanation for this could be that because they are experts already on digital capabilities, developing digital solutions, they might know what would be feasible or possible even more. So that might be an explanation, and that it's also something that came up also in the workshops we had later on. But that was a very kind of aha moment or striking moment when we first looked at the results, the data, and the graphs. So that could be one example where we were surprised, or I was surprised, we were really looking for explanations for this. And that's why the workshop is of such importance, to also get into a discussion on these nitty-gritty details. If you're not aware of these kind of effects, you could say, well, we need to throw even more resources, digital resources in what we are doing and so on.
There are many of these things. What spontaneously comes to my mind is, so the report, I think we could say they're in some way also quite complex, because we do benchmark them based on average values, which is very common in these kind of things where we say, like, on this dimension, you're, let's say, on average, I don't know, a one on a scale from -3 to +3. And that is already interesting if they then see that the rest is on average lower or higher. But we also report the internal agreement. So you asked about how many people do we get. We try to get as many people in a team as possible. So that also allows us to really say, like, how much is this, let's say, one on a scale from -3 to +3, how much is this shared? Is this because they are all giving it a one? That means there's high agreement that the organization is moderately good. It also could be the average from complete diverse opinions. And we report on that too. And that's also every time again in the workshop, a little bit aha moment for a lot of people. Like, okay, now I get it. This is much more complex, because they have to think about means and agreement, and every constellation is possible, a high or low mean score and high or low agreement. And that is also something where there's always someone in the room thinking, like, my team, I give them a lot of autonomy or something, or my team is great. And then they see, let's say I have a score of 1.5 or even 2, but then they realize that the agreement is low, meaning that a certain fraction, 25%, is not at all happy about the autonomy or the dynamics. And then you really see sometimes very confident CEOs, mainly male then, very confident, I have the best team. And then you have to show a little bit, like, but from the whole group today, you seem to have, like, a very diverse group in that opinion. So it means, like, a few people are not following at all. And that's a completely different set of learning points then, because they don't have to think about moving up the average. They have to make sure the group is more homogeneous again, that they share the same opinion in terms of like maybe it was a definitional thing, maybe they see it different, maybe there's really some hidden thing in there. So that is also something that pops up where then people afterwards say, okay, thanks. It was a whole day workshop, but it was worth going through this. So that is definitely also an element. I think we could go on for another 7 hours.
Maybe one more example, yes. If I may. So one dimension that we look at within the process, but also with the tool, is organizational slack. And organizational slack refers to, are there any additional resources available that are not bound, so to speak, to a certain concrete project or a product or whatsoever? So this means, do we have additional time resources or human resources or maybe some surplus financial resources that we could devote, for instance, to the topic of innovation? And especially among the group of nonprofits, we would often find that organizational slack or the availability of organizational slack is rather low. One explanation for this that you would also find in research is, for instance, the forms and types of funding that they receive. Many funders, especially the public funders, are not very keen on overheads, but at the end of the day, innovation and investing resources in innovation is technically can be seen as overheads. So that's one dimension where especially nonprofits actually rate themselves rather low, which makes sense actually when we go back into literature and try to find some explanations on why it is like this.
And now you mentioned, of course, like for instance, if we stay on the example of the CEO and autonomy, this is something where you as an organization, of course, and you as a CEO can trigger changes. Now, in the workshops you were mentioning, are you then like using these opportunities as feedback on the survey, basically, you were mentioning, purely analytical, or is there already some path forward also pictured in these workshops?
Yes, again, very good question. And that's something we didn't have in mind from the beginning, but after multiple workshops and 50 organizations. So I think there are two paths forward. What we always ask people, but in the end, they can choose how well they do it. But we always ask to not just leave the workshop very often. It's, let's say, on a Friday or something, and then they leave it the weekend, they are reflecting, and on Monday they go back to usual business. So we really let them reflect, and sometimes we actually ask it, like, please, within 2 weeks, can you give us some kind of a report on what were now your main learning points and what are you doing to get it involved, introduced in the organization? And we get all kind of reactions. People say like, oh, no, please. So I have like fires to extinguish. So it's hard. So others, they are very happy. Thanks for pushing me again, because I don't want to let this value go to waste. So that is one thing where we push them and so on. But we realized that we could even do more. But again, we're also a limited capacity. We have some slack, not too much. And then we realized, but that's together with our co-author on all of this. That's Caroline Waldner, currently in Berlin at the ESP. And we realized like we should follow up also to learn, not necessarily for the survey. Partially we did, but also like, how are people turning this into practice in real action? So we give them really good tips, and they develop tips themselves during the workshop. So that's good. But we have actually until recently, we didn't have like a really good view on, is it really working? So that's why we started with, let's say, some kind of a follow-up project. All the 50 organizations who participated up till now, they got an invitation for extra interviews. And that's something that Caroline is leading together with some teaching assistants. So all organizations are invited for one or two follow-up talks. And again, there, up till now, it's preliminary results. The feedback is, like, for some of them, sorry, we didn't do a lot with this, but thanks for the reminder. You're right, a little bit a social guilt feeling. Others give really clear feedback, like, yeah, thanks, because now I have to think about it again. We did indeed have some actions, but now I can follow up again on them. a few organizations, they were incredibly positive. They are like now asking, can we do an extra round? Can we do it again, the tool, and so on, and go again through it to see if we learn from it? Are the relationships or the proportions, are they changed? Do we have new weak spots or something? So, and that is a complete double purpose. It's to remind them, but we're also learning from it if we can improve our workshop. Actually, one of the learning points we have in mind is that the feedback element from us, maybe we should structure it even more. So up till now, it's for them generating ideas and we support that based on anecdotes and interviews of about 50 organizations, I think up till now 36 answered, that we can maybe give very concrete examples to make it even more graspable. So indeed, there is this follow-up trajectory. It's work in progress, but it is to make sure our impact is even higher, but also to learn from about the whole process. And the first 50, I think it's 52 organizations we had them, we also made an update to the survey. So the main questions remain, but we added a few extra. Again, we learned for some people, it's about 100 questions in total. So that's some time. But actually, we got mainly the feedback from a few people. It's long. But a lot of people said, like, maybe it's worth adding a few more questions because then we get even more information on other important elements that can help us to make good decisions. So we made an update. Let's say it's the MATSI 2.0 now. But that was really like based on feedback from these extra interviews and from what people said then in the workshops about the tool. Yeah.
Great. Now we discussed a lot now also, of course, the question, what is in there for the organizations, for the units, the practitioners. Still, if we would need to boil it down to, let's say, an elevator pitch or a 10 seconds, one sentence thing, what's in there for social innovators when they would like to use the MATSI tool?
I think it's so what's in there for them, it's an opportunity to learn in a very structured and efficient way. You get a lot of information with very little effort. So that's the pitch. You can learn a lot, self-evaluation with relatively less investment, but, and that's the other side of the coin, this minimal level of investment is necessary. So it means one key person should convince the team to answer this survey. We had one or two people, either not in the final sample anymore. They could just convince themselves and their neighbors. The report wasn't representative and so on, so we don't consider it anymore in the sample. The person actually learned, I should have invested more. So that is a bit the thing. So people should invest in, first of all, make sure people answer it, that they answer it genuinely, all this kind of stuff. And also invest in this, you know, in this workshop. We once had a person said, yeah, I just want to follow a bit online. We said, no, don't do it. So it could come after the day, said like, yeah, fair enough. That was worth the investment. So that would be the pitch. A lot to learn given a minimal level of investment. And then it's a good trade-off. It's a good trade-off. Yes.
Super. Of course, you mentioned a little bit, Jung, that this is a two-way street, and Rainer, maybe the question to you, having the research head a little bit on and the academia head, of course, having like data of 50 organizations is something some researchers dream of maybe. Are there any plans like working with this data also with this head on?
As implicitly, let's put it that we mentioned, we are already doing this with the follow-up research, also in collaboration with Caroline Waldner. So that's where we also more in a kind of a deep dive, not only follow the organizations, but also gather additional qualitative data on what did the tool and the experience mean for them, how did it help them, and so on. So that's already in the pipeline. Besides still offering the MATSI tool to different organizations or intermediaries, maybe we'll come to that at the end, and also collecting additional data, further refining the tool, the process, and so on. But there is a kind of an academic level to it where we look on all of it again.
Now, the tool and the work is, of course, in my head at least, very highly correlated now with development, right? Development of different factors. So you can harvest social innovation even better in your organization. Now, if we go to the macro perspective, maybe a little bit from your perspective, social innovation, how does social innovation evolve? What are like trends for the future, both on research and practitioner side?
So the discussion on social innovation is not necessarily very new. So there has been already some debates 30, 40 years ago, but it has been kind of, and there's a paper on it called that way, it has been rediscovered, not only from academics and from researchers, but also from, let's say, the field. Goes a little bit along with the upcoming discussion 15, 20 years ago around social entrepreneurship and others. So social innovation will remain relevant as a practice in the field. What we can observe, especially there, is that when it was rediscovered, there was a lot of focus on generating new ideas for existing or for new problems. So a lot of intermediaries, funders supported the idea of, okay, we need new ideas. Early stage whatsoever, but the question is, how does this turn into or can be turned into an innovation that persists over time? So that was followed up by this discussion on how to make it a sustainable innovation and whatsoever. And the most recent focus, let's say from the past few years, is on scaling. So many people have ideas. Maybe not all of them, but still some people have good ideas that really persist and become an innovation and so on. But the question is, how can you scale it up so that it reaches more people or more countries or different target groups or whatsoever? So that's one part to the discussion. It will remain relevant from a practical point of view, because societal problems are not getting fewer, so to speak, and new problems, new societal challenges arise. So I often bring the example of that with new technologies, new social problems also arise. So you would need to find ways to mitigate them. And this is also quite reflective in academia and research on it. So it will remain relevant. That is my point. If it's called social innovation, we will see. We tend to come up with new kind of specific labels or whatsoever. But it will remain, because the problems are either persistent or there will be new problems that need to be addressed on a societal level.
It's not an opposite observation, but from another perspective. If I also look, since I met Reinhard 15 years ago at a conference, I also think that the topic in academia is less niche. So before, I would have thought of like a few names, and they were social innovation researchers. And I think it's in some sense more mainstream, that like a lot of researchers would study it on top, additional, as a part. Because they are linking it with other topics. Like in those days, you also had non-profit governance researchers. There was also community. I think there are more bridges built. Like, how can we change governance in the organization so that we are more innovative? Or how are volunteers a force for social innovation or something? So I think in the research community, it's a bit blending or getting better integrated in other topics too. You also see it in certain journals. It wasn't a topic because you had very specific journals for it. You see it's popping up in general management journals, in policy journals and so on. And I think that is that's a good evolution. The downside could be that suddenly everything is a social innovation and everyone knows something about it. So, but I think that is it's a good evolution, that over the last 10, 15 years, it is less niche in research community, and therefore more people are involved. So it's more getting a lateral kind of topic. And that is, I guess, something that is, it's achieved. So that means it's there to kind of stay. That would be my, hypothesis, yes.
All right. So the topic of social innovation is going to accompany us for some time still.
Yes.
Now, if I have listened to this episode and if I said, wow, this Metsy tool sounds great, I work in an organization and want to get involved, is this possible? And if yes, how?
Yes, and yes. So that's the thing. But so what we again, if you look at how it works now, so we also have a little bit organizational Slack, but not too much. So a single organization participating, yes, but probably we will say, can you wait a little bit until we do a next batch? So we have like planned batches once a year where we then immediately do 10 or 15 organizations or something. So that is how we try to plan as much as possible. For us, it's more efficient, but also then we plan also one, maybe two workshops where there are then 5 to 10 organizations. So that is something that from a practical point of view to take into account. Another thing is also our organizations, they're parts of networks of umbrella organizations. If that would be the case where an umbrella organization says, like, actually, we represent 20 organizations, we want to go through this together, then it's efficient for us. We would love to offer that. But then also this umbrella organization, let's say we have a key contact person per organization, but this overall organization helps too in organizing this workshop, maybe on location or something. So then it's a win-win. It's efficient for us. But also for this organization, they have an extra session of a whole day and they can learn together. So they're exchanging with similar organizations. So that would be something as a booster or something to get more likely in this. So that's a bit the trade-off. Sometimes it also can be a third party or something, a funder or something who says, like, actually, this is important that for me, that the organizations that I fund go through something like this, then that is also an opportunity. But yeah, a single organization, fair enough. We will try to accommodate it in some way. But of course, if a group of teams or organizations say we want to do this, plus some support then also then for organizing and so on. If the group gets bigger, we also have some extra people supporting us or something. So then this is more likely and even better than in terms of learning from each other.
In the case that you're really kind of an individual, that is interested in learning more about social innovation in general, but also to get involved into these kind of approaches, tools and assessment, then the our Executive Master Program on Social Innovation and Management might be an option. So to apply for to send someone from the organization to go through this experience, because again, it meets the kind of advantage of being part of a group, having the opportunity to exchange within the group, or as you called it earlier, Martin, to be part of a community and to go through such a process. And that's a program that we offer in collaboration with VU Executive Academy. So you would find all information there. And that might be an option to become part of such a badge as an individual leader or manager or as an individual organization.
Perfect. Of course, we can also put the link to the Executive Master in the show notes. So if you want to click on it straight away, then please off you go. To be honest, I'm pretty much through the questions I've prepared. Is there anything you would like to communicate to our listeners which hasn't been discussed yet?
I think your questions were so well prepared that I don't have big topics that haven't been dealt with. So thank you very much for preparing this so well. Yes.
Thank you. Of course, this goes down like butter.
No, thanks a lot, Martin, for the invitation and the questions and the opportunity also to tell a little bit more what we're working on and what is close to not only our minds but also our hearts.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. Those are perfect closing words. Thank you for joining me in the studio today. Thank you for the work and all the best for the future and for Matti.
Thanks, Martin.
Bye-bye.
Yes, and that's the end of this episode. Thank you very much for listening. If you have feedback, do not hesitate to get in touch. On the one hand, this is possible via email insideimpact@wu.ac.at, or of course also our Instagram channel insideimpact with an underscore. Thank you for listening. With best regards from WU. All the best. Bye-bye.
Inside Impact.
Der Podcast mit Wirkung.